Rav Shlomo Goren. Let me just say a few words about Rav Shlomo Goren, who, of course, I can't say knew him intimately, but over the years I met with him quite a number of times, and I was in the rabbinate in the army, so I know the man. Again, when you come to Rav Shlomo Goren, it's a man like Rav Shlomo Kalbach. Great achievement, and at the same time, there's a certain nuance of tragedy in his life. And I'll tell you what the achievement is. Here you have someone from the Haredi world, the Hasidic world. You know, his father was a Polish Hasid, came in Aliyah to Kfar Hasidim. Goren was about 12, 13 years old. He was a kid. Gorenchik was the family name. And he winds up in the top yeshiva in Israel. At that time, there was really only one yeshiva outside of the Yeshiva Hayashan. Mech HaZarav was very small, but the real yeshiva was Chevron. Chevron was like Ponovich today. That was the yeshiva. And Rav Goren was one of, at a golden period in Chevron's history, he was one of the top iluyim, an unbelievable mind. Rav Goren's knowledge, you know, the Bavli Yerushalmi, photographic memory, and he got caught up with this entire creation of the State of Israel. He fought in the War of Independence. As a matter of fact, he first was a sharpshooter on Mount Zion, where we had an outpost. Later he fought for Katmon, which was conquered in, I believe it was 49, Katmon was conquered. And he literally was a fighter. So here you had a man, he was a London Mufak, on one hand. On the other hand, he was caught up with the great Zionist dream and the creation of the state. And the best of Hebron went that way. If you go into the top graduates of Hebron, every last one became a great Zionist and did good things in the state. I can mention other names from his period. Rabbi Saul Zholti, Zecher Tzadik Livracha, went on to become the chief rabbi of Jerusalem. Another example, Professor Menachem Alon, the famous Professor Alon, who of course today is today retired. He's an older man. He's in his 70s. But he was the head of the Supreme Court, and the Mishpat Avri, what achievement. President Chaim Herzog, another man in his 70s today. This is also from Hebron at that time. And you have the entire world, one graduate after another from Hebron, successfully merged YU's greatest dream, great Torah knowledge, and at the same time the ability to be part of the modern world, the Zionist world. They were caught up with this tremendous dream. Now, when Ben-Gurion organized the army, and this you have to understand, and I don't have time to go into it, but as much as we look back and maledict Ben-Gurion, Ben-Gurion said one word that was unbelievable. He once said to the Mizrahi people, he says, "Today you fight with me and you curse me," he says, "there will come a time when your grandchildren will long for Apikrasim like I am." And that was a meridic vart, because what Ben-Gurion was saying was, even though he himself was not from, but he appreciated, he knew what Yiddishkeit was, and he understood that in order for Israel to be a Jewish state, compromises had to be made. And that was Ben-Gurion's famous speech in the Knesset. Remember, you fellas have no appreciation. I get very upset. I was talking with the editor of Tradition last night. He came into America. He came into Israel, the president. He stayed for Shabbos. So he's giving me, on my big article on the Rav, he's giving me Musar, I left something out. He says, what you have, everybody knows, you know, it's 11,000. I said, Menachem, anyone under 35 doesn't know one word of the article. We know. Everybody wants me to put in something fine. I know what he wants. He wants the whole lawsuit in Boston with the Rav, which I'm going to research. I've made the connections now to get the material, because I was afraid I'd have to go up to Boston. And even though I can stay enough in his house, I don't have the time to do it right now. But I think I'll be able to handle it from here. So, you know, when I talk about these things, you're missing this whole background. It's a new generation. Ben-Gurion got up in the Knesset. How was the Israeli Defense Forces formed? Before the State of Israel, you had the Palmach. The Palmach was broken into two divisions. You had the regular Palmach and the religious Palmach. Then you had Eitzel. Then you had Lehi. Finally, they formed one army. And what kind of army do you have? You got to remember, in the Israeli army, there is religious coercion as a result of Ben-Gurion. Because instead of having two armies, one like they had in Palmach, the Plugat Datiyot, Yerushalayim had a tremendous Plugat Datiyot. You know what that meant, the Plugat Datiyot? From the top commander, who was a major or a lieutenant colonel down, Everyone was religious. I happen to know who the commander was. He lives in Kiryat Moshe. He's an old man today. He was the lieutenant colonel. Everyone is religious. Petah Tikva, B'nai Brak, Tel Aviv, each area had a plugat datit. And you could have gone on and had two armies here. And Ben Gurion said, he got up in the Knesset and said, we're going to have an army where every soldier will have a belt, and on the belt there'll be room for a canteen, and there'll be room for tefillin for those soldiers who want to carry their tefillin with them. And that was Ben Gurion's viewpoint. And the army was established, and you know, according to the law of the land, I'm not telling you fairy tales, this is, if you know what I'm saying, b'pkuda. You're not allowed to mix meat and milk in the army. The kitchen has to be kept kosher. You're not allowed to turn on a light in the kitchen. You're not allowed to turn on the fire on the oven on Shabbat. This is by law. And in the army, they're not allowed to make you do a munim on Shabbat. In other words, when what we call batash, bitachon shoteif, that's pikuach nefesh. That's allowed. But if some commander is mad at you and wants you to do 50 push-ups on Shabbat, you may have to listen to him, but you can file a complaint against him after Shabbat, and he'll come up in trial. And if he's an officer, he'll be thrown into jail. If he's not an officer, he'll lose pay and he'll lose privileges. But officers have sat in jail for mixing meat and milk, or for turning on fires on Shabbos and making it impossible for the religious boys to eat in the kitchen. And this is Ben Gurion. Now, in order to accomplish this, he needed someone to head up the rabbinate in the army. And this is where he calls upon Shlomo Gurion. And this was the greatest achievement. There was never a better person. In other words, if ever a job was tailor-made for an individual, it was Rav Shlomo Gurion being chief rabbi. He was a tremendous lamed, and he wasn't afraid to paskin. He had great learning. He had feeling for Eretz Yisrael. He had feeling for an army. He had the understanding of pikuach nefesh. He had the guts to be mekil where he had to be mekil. And he was, nothing could stop him. You understand? Sometimes when you have great learning, it gives you self-confidence. He was like a bulldozer. You never could start up with him. They used to tell stories in the army. When I came in, I was right after the Gurion period. So they used to say, we have problems with kashrut today. So they used to complain to the assistant chief rabbi, to the chief rabbi. Until it got settled, it took 2 months. They used to tell me when Rabbi Gurion was chief rabbi, you made one call on a Saturday night, and you told him in this base, this and this happened. The next day, he was at that base, and heads rolled. All the, you know, he was a general already, and the guys running a base are majors. The major shivered in his presence, religious, irreligious. This is the Pkudan. He had Ben Gurion behind him. He had Moshe Dayan behind him. If ever a man had the right place in life, it was Rav Gurion as the general and as the head of the rabbinate in the Israeli army. Now, that was the great achievements of Rav Gurion. And you read his volumes, you'll see where he deals with the army and the Six-Day War. I mean, these were moments. Those of you that have not heard the tape recording, remind me, someday I'll bring it in for you. That was one of, if I'm sitting here, Binyamin, it's the result of Rav Gurion's blowing the shofar at the cult. I'll take my word for it. That shofar got rid of all the Rav. The Rav almost ruined my life when he told me to remain there. I was a B'nai Kivinik. I was going, yeah, I told you. The Rav said, no, you have to, you're teaching Torah. The students love you. You know what it means that I have a, we have a Rebbe whom the students relate to, and you can teach a Tosfot. He says, that's what he said to me. That's, Lubavitch Rebbe had the same viewpoint, by the way. Rabbi Green of Toronto wanted to call Rabbi Green of Wethy, you know, the suburb of Toronto, Hamilton. He went to the Lubavitch Rebbe the same time that I went in Aliyah. I remember it like yesterday, 68. And the Rebbe said to him, remain in Hamilton, you're teaching Torah, you're successful as a rabbi. The Rebbe's viewpoint was exactly the same. And I remained in America until Rav Gurion blew the shofar at the Kotel. Then I could never sleep again in Baruch Hashem. So Rav Gurion was the right man in the right place. The tragedy in his life, and this is what all the newspapers harped on, and you know, it hurts when a person dies. I can't believe how right away they zeroed in on his difficulties. When he leaves the army and he comes into civilian life, he never was able to adjust. And I'll tell you why. Personality-wise, he was cut out for the army. The army, when you go up the ranks of command in the army, as you go higher and higher in rank, you're no longer requesting, you're giving orders. And it becomes very comfortable, you understand, when you can give orders, and I've seen it, and I remember I was in the army many, many years, and I lectured for these heavyweights, and I used to see, I'll never forget, when I had the entire Pikud of Aza came up to listen to the rabbinate for a few days. And here I am lecturing and sitting in the room as a general. The whole room centered around that general. I couldn't believe my eyes. Everyone there. There was no one under the rank of captain. But there was captains, the entire higher officer echelon of Pikud of the South. And you had captains and majors and lieutenant colonels and colonels and a brigadier general sitting right there. I saw the way they formed around that general. As a matter of fact, it was one of the greatest moments of my life. I had a miracle during that lecture, but it's not for now. Someday I'll tell you that story with that general at that lecture. But I saw the way they relate to him. A general. Then you come into civilian life, and you have to deal with people. You have to fawn over them. You have to be nice to them. I remember Lo Aleinu Rav Moshe Feinstein. I used to get letters in the mail from Rav Moshe Feinstein. I used to open the letters. I still have many of them. Requests for tzedakah. Rav Moshe himself has to sign. I mean, remember how much time Rav Baron Kuttner had to go around raising money. The Rav and all the eulogies you heard for the Rav, you heard how much the black world praised him for how he helped them raise money. And you have to fawn, you have to give a balabas cover. That I do. All of you remember, at least you've heard the stories of the Rav's legendary talk when Mr. Gruss dedicated the Beit Medrash in the yeshiva, the new Beit Medrash, the Rav's legendary talk in honor of Mr. Gruss. And of course, this is civilian life. You have to be good to the hand that has the butter. You have to know how to deal with it. You can't give orders. Even to students, I was just talking before class, even to students, by the 1970s, the Rav used to tell people he's afraid of the students. He used to tell openly, he says, they check my tzitzis, they do this, they do that. But you're a Rebbe, you want to be popular. Rabbi Yossi Soloveitchik told me about his father, that there's that terrible fear that students are going to leave you. You're not going to have whom to teach Torah to. This is civilian life. You can't give orders. And Rav Gorin had a lot of difficulty. This was his rabbinate, and he was constant machloket. And it was, of course, with Rav Ovadia Yosef. Now, in retrospect, we already see Rav Ovadia Yosef's personality, so you can understand the way their 10 years as chief rabbis was one endless scoop for the newspapers. You know, even with pulling out grass out of the kolkal, I don't know if you recall, it became front page news here. It's based upon a Gemara and Megillah, where Rabbi Knesset b'chur banam, are you allowed to pull the grass out or you're not allowed to pull the grass out? Maybe you're supposed to leave the grass there to make the avail at all the greater. So even that became a source of controversy. The newspapers jumped on it and it was very, very sad. And I felt sorry for Rav Goren. My feelings were, here is a great man, and I see this man caught up in a world which he can't succeed in. And I used to say to myself, halavai, halavai, he could have remained or should have remained in the army. There he was in the right place. Civilian rabbinate with 10 years of heartache and achmat nefesh. Now, what they did pay tribute to, of course, and they spoke about the heartache, the achmat nefesh, what they did pay tribute to is his psakim. And here I have to mention, there's no question on two areas, and I'll deal with it in the coming years in great detail. In two areas, he was overwhelming, and in my humble opinion, and I don't say I know it all, but there's some areas of Torah Baruch Hashem that I think I know quite well. In my humble opinion, I think he was absolutely right. And one is a great pain in my heart, because until today I cannot deal with it. And that, of course, is the Langer case. This brother and sister suspected of Mamzeret, and Rav Goren uncovered, this is the early 70s, they were both in the army at the time, and Rav Goren uncovered unbelievable material, checking social workers' reports, going back to the British Mandate in Tel Aviv, and he really uncovered Sveikot, that it could very well be that their father was not Jewish, the woman's original husband was not Jewish, I should say, and if that's the case, a second marriage to Langer was not adulterous, and therefore these kids were not Mamzerim. The entire rabbinic world, except for Rav Henkin, opposed him. And to this day, I can't make my peace with it. Because if you're fighting politics, it's one thing. But how do you fight politics when you kill a brother and sister in the process? I cannot make my peace with it. I don't understand it. I have to tell you, the Lubavitcher Rebbe said, even if he's right, he's wrong because he got graft, he got shochad, they made him chief rabbi because he was mate, even if he's right. My Rebbe, the Rav, said privately, Rav Goren is right. In public, he kept his silence, he didn't say anything. Rav Moshe didn't come out in favor. No one came out, no one helped him. And halachically, he was absolutely right. I don't understand.
understand how gedolei haposkim. I mean, Ribbono Shel Olam, I know a little bit about being matim amzerim, and this is before Rav Moshe's seventh volume. When you look at Rav Moshe's, what is it, the seventh volume, Ribbono Shel Olam, there isn't a mamzerit case that he doesn't find a heter for. I have to say, only Rav Henkin. Rav Yosef Eliyahu Henkin, who then was a blind man, and I imagine Chazal say that Eva Chashiv to mate, and therefore had nothing to fear, and was totally honest. Only Rav Henkin, and it's on tape, they recorded it, as he spoke. Rav Henkin said, Rav Goren is absolutely right, the Achvachot Amuta, and he didn't understand why there was such opposition. And see, he got caught up in politics. But what breaks my heart, and maybe this was an overture to what's going to happen, is how do you allow politics to enter into a psak that affects a boy and girl? And it opened up a whole new world to me. People said to me, well, the boy and girl are not religious. Why, you know, if it was in B'nai Brak and they'd be firm, there we can be sweet. We can sacrifice Olam Haba. But to sacrifice Olam Haba for people that are so distant from religion, I mean, I couldn't take answers like that. I suffered very greatly, and until today, I don't have an answer. I can explain the machloket, I can explain, but halacha lamaisa, when you break open mamzeret with so many great sveikot, how can you fight, even if you don't like the man and his method wasn't right? But ad kedei kach, and that remains a source of controversy until today. He published an entire sefer explaining his case. What's your problem? What's your problem? I can't explain it. See, that troubles me. That machloket, and it shook the state of Israel. You fellas were young at the time, but, you know, I was all early 70s. It shook the state of Israel. You have no idea. It was on TV and radio and day and night, and all you heard about the Langer children, the boy and the girl. And this, of course, was his famous psak in Heter Mamzeret, which I have to say, to the best of my humble knowledge, the man was absolutely right. With Heter Agunot, there already, he was on firmer ground and no one contested him. And until today, the entire Israeli Defense Forces works with his viewpoint. And while the newspapers and everyone, the radio and the TV today gave him all the credit in the world, as a Lamdan, I have to say, what he was doing was utilizing the approach of a Pitzchokhan inspector of the Treirube. In other words, the whole concept of Mayan She'en Lehem himself is only a rabbinic concept. From Torah law, if a man is missing and you can assume he's dead, you're allowed to make the assumption. Someone who drowns in water and he doesn't come out, we assume he's dead. However, because miracles can happen, those of you who are familiar with the Gemara, it's the end of Yevamah, Daf Kaf Aleph, Kaf Kaf Bet. Those of you familiar with the Gemara, and I trust that you're all familiar with it, sometimes miracles happen. And a person goes into a well, the well saves him, he gets on a board of water, the board saves him. So therefore we made a gezerah because of Chumrat Desh Adish, and that gezerah is the famous gezerah Mayim Shein Lehem himself. Rabbi Yitzchok Hanan said that, yes, you make a gezerah if there's one rove, but if there are two roves, nothing in the world stands against Trei Rubei. And Rabbi Yitzchok Hanan already developed in his time, 100 years ago, number one, if a boat went down in the ocean, many boats going to America, lower lane, was sunk in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean. The boats were never recovered. It's number one. The majority of people on a boat that sinks at sea, catches fire at sea, the majority of the people die. Number two, the majority of people who survive would have contacted their wives within a reasonable period of time. And so Hanan says we have post international mail. Again, you take it for granted. It's a big thing. We have telegrams. Tzulchanan, you follow me, David? Tzulchanan. Nowadays, Allah had come of a comma. Rav Goren said, the majority of men who survive, we have international Red Cross. We have embassies. We have consuls. We have telephones. We have newspapers. We have so many ways of contacting our wives. So therefore, he would set up a Beit Din, waited a year after the Yom Kippur War. That was the war we had almost 900 plus agunat. I can yet remember demonstrations of hundreds and hundreds of women agunat pleading for the Israeli army to get more information about their late husbands. At the end of the year, a reasonable period of time, Bizman Azeya Paskin a year, each case individual merits, because you have to know, Shalom, again, the Mishnah Yevamot, Shalom Lo, Shalom La, I have to tell you the truth. There's some men in Israel who are now setting all types of records. 14 women have been killed in the last 2 years by their husbands. The last killing was last Thursday. And I think every last one of the 14 men was wearing a yarmulke when he killed his wife. Maybe some of them put on talit and tefillin. See, so this is a new way. You don't like your wife, she's been bothering you. Look at the picture of the guy that was just arrested Thursday. You'd think he was going to say kol nidrei in shul, the way he looked. Got rid of his battle axe, and he's willing to rot away in jail the rest of his life. Lo aleinu, 14 women. It's mind-boggling. Killed by Bahari. Jack and I were just talking Shabbos. He stabbed his wife, what was it, 94 times. And this is the guy with a big yarmulke. He just died in jail. 94 times he stabbed his wife. So the Mishnah says, you have to know, shalom la, shalom lo. It could be one of you guys is married. The greatest thing you want to do is disappear, leave your wife, start all over again, to hell with her. You know, it's an open Mishnah. You follow me, Chaim? Guys, this is an open Mishnah. So you have to meet with the couple. You have to meet with the woman. She has to bring proof that they were happily married. Happily married doesn't mean you don't have an... If a married couple doesn't have an argument when they're first married, they're not married. That's part of life, part of growing up. We're all headstrong, we're all self-centered. If you didn't hear Rakepit's lectures, you're certainly going to have arguments. If you heard that idiot Rakepit's lectures, the chances are you won't have arguments. But people who didn't hear the lectures, so you get married to headstrong people, so you have arguments, but that doesn't mean you're not happily married. You have to be certain they're happily married. Then he would establish where the chayal was last seen, and there would always be testimony. He was at the, you know, someone survives, the tank took a direct hit, whatever it was. So then you have a row. The majority of people on the Egyptian front where the tank took a direct hit were killed. And then the second row, had they survived, they would have contacted their family. And that's where Kissinger played a big role. See, one thing you have to say about Kissinger, he was not a Jew anymore, but he was not a Meshumer. There's a difference. The Rav said this, and what I'm trying to say, if you didn't chap it, is that Kissinger was not a Jew. You know, it's a disgrace. His father was the Gabbai of the German Minion. His mother were a Scheitel. And he, as a kid, was in Aguda, was in Ezra, the Ezra youth group, in Aguda, that they found in the Aguda offices, they found an essay he wrote on Mitzvah Yishuv Aretz, where he won a prize when he was, I think, 14 years old in Germany. And then this Kissinger goes on to conquer the world, and he marries Nancy on Shabbos. So a good Jew he was not. But he didn't hate the Jewish people. I'm assuming he wasn't. So Kissinger came back, and he gave testimony to Rav Gorin that Sadat gave him his solemn word of honor that there is not one Jewish prisoner in their hands that they haven't accounted for. So on that basis, he was able to make the second row. And Rav Gorin was matir 900 agunot, each one with a beitin, and Rav Gad Navon sat with him. It's terrific. That no one took issue with. That was one of his great achievements, and that, of course, is what the radio was talking about all day today. Of course, they don't explain it, but I'm explaining to you what they mean. I have to say, as a result of those 900 bateidinim, Rav Gad Navon, who shortly thereafter became the chief rabbi of the Israeli Defense Forces, and he's still the chief rabbi until today, Rav Gad Navon introduced tremendous technique into the army, and we don't have any problems with Agunat anymore. Every chayal, the day you go into the army, before you've been given your uniform, you are fingerprinted, your teeth are charted. They have so many different ways, and all that is kept on file for identification purposes. And today, Baruch Hashem, the army is able, has forensic medical means of identifying, and they can do miracles with identifying lo aleinu soldiers who come back in various states. I mean, it's sometimes the way bodies come back. This is why in the army, you know, they bury with coffins. Yeah, did you ever wonder why? All civilian funerals here are not with coffins. The army is always with a coffin. It's a takana of the rabbinate of the army, mishum lo plug. You don't want the family sometimes to see the body. So you always bury with a coffin. Sometimes very little of the body survives. Lo aleinu, if a tank is blown up by a missile, very little survives. But you know that this heap was once a human being, lo aleinu. You always bury with a coffin. It's low plug in the army. They have wonderful means. And Rav Gorin put in chumras, with every army coffin, there's a little hole on the bottom of the coffin. You don't see it. That hole, so even according to the Kabbalah, that you're not allowed to use the coffin and the body has to mix with the dust, that hole takes care of that Kabbalah, takes care of that Kabbalistic tradition. This is all Rav Gorin. He did great things in the army. You have no hasaga from everything in the army. Now, the final thing I just want to comment on is, of course, they went crazy with him, with his Psakim and Yehuda V'Shomra and the newspapers today. I bought gas this morning, so if you buy gas, you're treated to your diyah. They give it to you for nothing. I don't know, sometimes sona matanet yichyeh, sometimes it may be better not to take the matana, but you know, I'm like most Jews. If so, like they say about yeshiva boys say, if you're giving, I take. That's what they used to say. They used to say about yeshiva boys, they could make kiddush five times Shabbos morning. It was the shita. If the food is there, I eat. So if a guy gives me, the guy says to me this morning, if I fill up, he says, kibalta yediyot, lo kibalot, vakasham. He runs inside, brings me out of yediyot. You might think he's giving me a panach there. He did it with such dechilu rechimu. So I see in the yediyot, they list out Rabbi Goren's pronouncements on Yehuda v'Shomron and Melchemet Mitzvah and losing a sixth of the army and you have to fight. Gentlemen, every word he says is an open Gemara. That losing a sixth of the army is a Gemara in the Darim. Everything's an open Gemara. But I'll tell you, we're living at very difficult times now. We are living at times where the leaders of the Jewish state have no connection with Jewish history. So of course, when Rabin can say last Wednesday, and I call your attention to the best of my knowledge, not one religious leader in the state of Israel has spoken up outside of myself, my own little circles, and I can't say I hit the masses, but not one religious leader. What did Rabin say? The height of Aprikoras, Corset. This prime minister gets up and he doesn't quote anything from the scriptures, not a word, nothing is quoted. He was evidently, he said to me, Samachan, that Rav Shaya Shevkon read some psukim, all right, that was the religious aspect. The one pasuk he quotes very dramatically, and he's not a good speaker, but at this point he gets carried away. Lo oldam levadad yishkon. Gentlemen, when a person speaks like that, he has cut himself off from all of Jewish history, past, present, and future. Because the Torah says, am levadad yishkon, uven gayim lo yitchashev. This is our destiny, this is the essence, the heart of our existence. You understand me? There's no way we can overcome it. We have to get along with the nations, agreed. We have to have commercial relations with the nations, agreed. We have to have cultural relations, everything is fine. But you have to understand, the bottom point is, am levadad yishkon. We are different, our destiny is different, our Weltanschauung is different, our Gestalt is different. This is everything Torah teaches us about. And this is where we stand. We now raised, if I can end off the way I began, Ben Gurion's words have unfortunately come true. His grandchildren, the leaders of the country today, have nothing to do with any continuity of Jewish tradition. Jewish understanding, Jewish knowledge, Jewish vision, Jewish foresight. Ben-Gurion hit the nail on the head. He was an apikoros, but he yet understood what it means, Shmir Shabbos, Kashrut. He yet understood why a Torah Jew can't compromise on these issues. He yet understood why the unity of the Jews required the sacrifice of a Navi that's kosher and Sabbath observing, of chuppah v'kedushin b'day harabanut. He understood that. Today's generation, kachol ha-goyim beit Yisrael. This is exactly our Prime Minister Rabin, our Foreign Minister Peres, he's the architect of the whole peace plan which has exploded, Yossi Beilin, of course. And as one Rosh Hashiva, Yom Hashishi, said something very fascinating. I wish they would have identified the Rosh Hashiva, but they said Friday night they knew that something very big was on because it seems in Kriyat Moshe there's a very high-ranking army officer who lives there in the Shabak, in the Shirit B'chaton Klali, and whenever there's a big pula, they don't lift a finger without his decisions. So it seems on Friday they came to his house right before Shabbos, and they took him into the army, and everyone in the neighborhood knew that there's something big happening with Nachshon Vaxna, Hashem Yikom Damo. So they meet this Rosh Yeshiva coming home from Shul Friday night, and you know, everyone was wishing it was a terrible Shabbos. That Shabbos, I don't have to tell you, the words pass from word to word, mouth to mouth. So they meet, they tell the Rosh Yeshiva that there's going to be there's a big pool on the way, a big answer. The Rosh Yeshiva, like this, he says, Zelo Yazar Shum Davar LeMemshala Hazot, in Shum Siyata Deshmaya. And that was unbelievable what he answered. Nothing's going to help because this government has no Siyata Deshmaya. And that's exactly what happened. Those of us that know, have lived through, we have never yet seen the army undertake a rescue attempt and bungle it so completely. Understand? You don't attempt a rescue attempt where the only result is going to be death. You have to use seichel, insight. How do you come to a door and don't put on enough explosives? You know, we're not dealing with kids here. We're not dealing with, if I'm going to teach Aleph-Bet, I better know Aleph-Bet. The guy that set the explosives for that door had to be a world-class expert. Otherwise, he doesn't belong in the Sayeret Ramatkal. You're not dealing here with normal soldiers, the guys that are your milkmen on during the weekend and serving miluim on weekends. We're dealing here with the cream of the cream, la creme de la creme. And there's no siyata d'shmaya. This government, they sign a peace treaty, and the day they're signing peace treaties, we're still sitting shiver for the most terrible tragedy that I know of, that I can remember in years. What happened in Dizengoff is still overwhelming. And take a look on Shabbos, the soldier that fell, they tell his father, it's almost like the Rub, it's exactly the Rub stories in Ish Halacha that everyone laughed at. You know, the Rub was attacked in the early 80s. Two big shots came out with a whole article that Rabbi Soloveitchik hates his family. That's why he tells these stories to make his family look ludicrous. In the American Jewish Yearbook with the famous article by Singer and so here, and his exact story. Remember the Netziv with the telegram on Shabbos and on Yontif, and he doesn't say a word, folds it, puts it in his pocket, goes on dancing, shmuas. After Habdal, he breaks into terrible tears, takes off his shoes. The telegram told him his only sister had died. The father was told on Shabbos. Why they tell on Shabbos, I have no idea, but I guess they don't want rumors to spread, so they come on Shabbos to tell you your son was killed. The father didn't tell his wife till after Habdalah. And this is our problem today. Today we have two Israels here. We have the Israel of Yitzchak Rabin, and we have the Israel of that father, of that soldier from Golani. We don't have a Ben Gurion. We don't have anyone that can stand in the middle. It's totally lacking. And this is Rabbi Gorin. This is Rab Gorin. If you see the papers today, you believe in Eretz Yisrael. You quote a Maimah Chazal, they're putting someone on trial from Kiryat Arba for quoting a Rambam. For quoting a Netziv, there's a famous Netziv, it's two places in the Netziv, in Breshit and Devarim, that at a time of war, you're allowed to shoot indiscriminately. Kol Zman, the enemy is fighting, you're allowed to shoot indiscriminately. He is going on trial for advocating the killing of innocent civilians. That trial will take place while you're still here in Israel. This is where we're at today. This could have never happened 40 years ago, 30 years ago, or even 20 years ago. But it's the third generation raised on a curriculum that is totally void of any Jewish value. And this is Rav Gorin's greatness, it's Rav Gorin's tragedy. Rav Gorin combined both worlds. The Haredi world didn't understand him anymore. They saw him too much of a Zionist. But now the tragedy is infinitely greater. Because at least he had a world that was with him, the Dati world, the Zionist world. Rav Gorin here was a world-class hero for everybody. And today, that very Zionist world doesn't understand the person who loves Shem, loves Chevron, quotes the Bible, quotes a Psak, quotes a Gemara. This isn't in their context. All they have is a concept of Western culture, Western democracy, as they understand it, as Shulam Aleloni understands it, as Amnon Rubinstein understands it, as Yad Saban understands it, as Micha Goldman understands it, as Dali Itzik understands it, as Yael Dayan understands it, Eilu Elohecha Yisrael. And in their framework, there is nothing Jewish whatsoever. And this is why the great Rabbi Gorin, who is so much an integral part of Israeli society, 20 years ago, worshipped and admired, take a look in his death, how they're giving such a mixed review, his great achievements, and the tremendous problems with the so-called extreme statements they made. And they're such ignoramuses, that when he quoted the Gemara, I happen to know exactly what Gemara is quoting. It's the same Gemara that Netziv quotes with 1/6 of the people, the king is not Nenash, this is the nature of war, lives are lost. And he quotes the Gemara. They're attributing it to him, and they're maledicting him and cursing him out, even in death. And this is exactly where we stand at this moment. This, to me, perhaps, is the greatest problem confronting us as Jews, as people reestablishing Jewish sovereignty on holy soil. Okay, so those are words on Rabbi Gorin, and I said a lot more than just on Rabbi Gorin, and there's a lot more to be said, but let me teach today, because Yair came not to hear about Rabbi Gurin, he came to hear words of Torah. Okay, now, Coming back here. What we said last week is so true. Men are basically bad people. We mistreat women, we take advantage of them. The stories that we hear, legendary, grabbing women on the street, giving them beautiful gifts, and saying harayt mekudeshetli, setting up witnesses, giving them candy bars, everything is true. How do we stop it? And we see that the early achronim in the Sephardic world did everything possible and came up with hapkod tradition. And even though you had machloket there, so they didn't want to be samachan at halacha lemaisa, so they came up with pisul ha'edim. But even with pisul ha'edim, I showed you that some of the very signatories, some of the very people who signed halacha lemaisa, everyone is afraid when it's eshetish. Eshetish is the most chumridic part of the Torah. It's frightening. And no one wants to be mekil. So they once again would say, yes, pisul ha'edim, but only mikan lahaba. Pisul ha'edim, only when they remember bishas maisa, maybe they forgot. Halacha lemaisa, no one really wanted to be samach on pisul ha'edim alone. No one wanted to be samach on hafkad kedushin alone. So with all the progress that we made, and all the innovative thinking, and all the chiddush, and remember, chiddush, I say this time and again, a girl just asked me, I have wonderful classes in Midrash Maria, my Sunday classes. I haven't taught a class like this since 1979 in Michlala. I just an unbelievable class. And I happen to know some of these girls, had one girl sitting there, her great-grandfather was the Degel Ruvain. I happen to know where these girls come from. Some of them come from tremendous Yichis Gedolei Yisrael, but the girls themselves are terrific. So a girl asked me today, in relation to a Chafetz Chaim, I can't go into detail, but a girl asked me very simply, she said, Rebbe, but aren't we like the conservatives? How are we allowed to make changes like this? And the question was a wonderful question, but the answer is very powerful. You're only not allowed to make changes when they're outside the halachic system. Within the halacha, you're always allowed to be innovative. As the Rebbe used to say, this was the greatest reward of halachic thinking, the chiddush. And every generation can add. Maknef the Gemara in Chulin, Dapsayin, I spent so much time on it last year. Makam Minichulava Tavlit Gaderba, there's a famous miri there. So, but with all the chiddush, the problem remains. And once again, water seeks its lowest common denominator. And once again, it always went back. Give the guy money, bribe the guy, buy him off, let him give a get. And time and again, I guess men can be bought off. Love is fine and love is good, but ultimately money speaks. The men were bought off, they gave the get, and you see it in the tribute, and it's very sad, because that's a precedent that lives on until today. Whenever you don't have the ability to declare the woman muteret, so we plead with the man, give the get. And in order to give it, we give money. Now, what's unbelievably fascinating is, leave the Sephardic world now. With all due respect to Yair and God, leave the Sephardic world, come into the Ashkenazic world at the same time. And now the Ashkenazic world at the start of the Achronim is shifting from Franco-Germany to Poland. Poland now, the greater Poland. Because when we speak of Poland, Poland at one time means Poland, Lithuania, White Russia, if you know what I'm saying. We mean Greater Poland. Greater Poland by the 1500s, slowly but surely, is becoming the heart of Torah Jewry. Now, what's fascinating is here you will not see any great innovative thinking. It's not like the Sephardic world. The Sephardic world was renowned for their ability to be lenient, to be mekil, all of you know the difference between, ultimately, the Shulchan Aruch and the Ramah. Although I have to tell you parentheses, if you want a good joke, the Rebbe always used to say that as mekil as the Shulchan Aruch is, he has one chumrah. And he says that chumrah is worth all the kulas. Cancels all, you know what chumrah? Glat. The dikat panim. that the Shulchan Aruch, he said, we don't eat klat. You know, when we grew up in America, the Rav never would eat klat. He wouldn't eat klat. He used to get hysterical when you mentioned klat to him because he had his hang-ups. He was in a slaughterhouse, and he claimed that the klat houses, later it turned out it may very well be true because they found terrible problems with satna. The Rav said, every slaughterhouse has to have a certain percentage of tafas. And he said, you can ask Rabban Lichtenstein, because Rabban used to go with him to his slaughterhouse where he gave hashgacha. And the Rav used to have like a percentage of tafas, 27%, 32%. He said it can vary, but it always has to be within this percent. And he said, if you're not getting that percent, it's a sign to shachtam are not doing their job, they're not your mind. And it turned out in the satma, they were getting 12% trey, 13% trey, much less. So the Rav went hysterical. He said, glat prasha, glat treif. And you know, we worshipped the Rav. That's all we had to hear from him. You know, there was a period in our life where we wouldn't go near glat. You said to someone, glat? No. Just give me plain kosher, not glat. Plain America, all you get is glat. Because someone explained to me in the OU, it doesn't pay. All the Svadim need glat. All the Hungarians need glat. All the Lakewood boys are ready to mock to and glat. So for financial, and all the YU guys are probably mock to and glat. So for financial reasons, all you have is glat. But the Rav used to say, all the kulas of the Shulchan Aruch, he says, but that one chumrah equals it all out. But nevertheless, you all know, the Sfadim were Mekil, the Ashkenazim, by and less were Machmir. By the way, do you know where the chumras of the Ashkenazim go back to? Without going into great detail, those of you that study with the Chaim Soloveitchik, anyone here take the Hasidei Ashkenaz. Everything goes back to the Hasidei Ashkenaz. They were pietist, and they were Machmir, and they turned chumr into a knot. And they went innovative. They didn't talk about Hafkat Kedushin, Pisolated, but the problem haunts them as well. Now, the first source I want to give you was a very fascinating source, nothing to do with Hafkat Kedushin, Pisolated, but simply fascinating because it's a description. And this source is, again, from the Mintz family. It's HaRav Moshe Mintz. And we know that Rav Moshe Mintz moved after 1499. We don't know the exact dates. You got to remember this is before the New York Times and before recorded history in that sense. But we know that he still was in Germany in 1499. The next time we pick him up, he is in Poland. So here is Rav Moshe Mintz from the famous Mintz family. This is a cousin of the Marie Mintz. This is the Maram Mintz. And he has now moved into Poland. And in the Chivat Maram Mintz, again, it's a rare sefer, Siman Kuftet. Right in the middle of Siman Kuftet, on page Kufchav Zayin Amid Aleph, the Maram Mintz gives a description of marriage in Poland and where it's different than what he saw in Germany. The description is unbelievably fascinating. I want to read it in detail and compare it. You'll see certain things we do today. It's literally all here in this description. Now, by the way, this Mintz family has remained rabbis in two modern times. There's a Rabbi Adam Mintz this is the family. He is a third generation. He's the assistant to Rabbi Lichtenstein in KJ. He is the third generation musmach of YU in his family. His grandfather was a musmach of YU in the 1920s. Zichrono Livracha. And this is the Mintz family. Wherever you find the Mintz are wild today, inevitably they descend from the Maram Mintz, the Marie Mintz, the Marie Wal. I've yet to uncover a Mintz are wild who didn't have this Yechis. So it shows you these were big German rabbinic families that somehow the tradition survived the passage of hundreds of years. So he says, first of all, you know when the weddings were? This is the first big chiddush. All weddings shifted to Friday. Remember when we dealt with the time of Rashi and the Balei Tosfot, so they would start the wedding Friday, finish the wedding Saturday night. Now that became too hard, it became too difficult. All weddings shifted to Friday. This was to remain the minhag in Eastern Europe for hundreds of years. Dov, I can't speak over you whispering. I'll show you unbelievable sources later. Not today, next week, it'll blow your minds. But every Friday there was the wedding. What's to be gained by the wedding of Friday? And I told you, it's common sense. the Suda. Exactly. Halavai, well, you didn't have to bring your own food, but it meant that poor people had a nice Shabbos meal. Halavai, we can have this minik today. By the way, some people still did it. I can still remember in Yerushalayim when the Mira Rosh Yeshiva's daughter got married, and I had just come in Aliyah, it had to be 69 or 70. I remember the Siddur Kedushin was Friday afternoon, and the Suda Nesuin was the Leil Shabbat. If I'm not mistaken, it has to be checked. Rav Chutna's only daughter, I think also there too, he did it Friday afternoon. Yeah, it has to be checked. You know what I'm talking about? Bruria, what's the name? Yona? What's the last name today? She heads up the Beit Yaakov program for foreign students in Yerushalayim. What's the last name? David, yeah. Bruria David. That's Rav Chutna's daughter. If I'm not mistaken, there too, Rav Chutna was a very wealthy man. He married a very wealthy woman. And he rented a hotel, as I recall. And if I'm not mistaken, the Siddur Kedushin was Friday afternoon. That was the minute. Very fascinating. Now, you know what else is fascinating? They did the ketuvah like Minhag Yerushalayim. Minhag Yerushalayim, see, there's a problem here. What point are you obligated to give the woman a ketuvah? The truth of the matter is that the obligation of ketuvah begins with Nesuin, not with Kedushin. Kedushin, fine, but the whole obligation that her Maisa Yodeha belonged to you and you have to support her and she has to live with you, Korachara, that a woman's obligated to have relations with her husband, it's a very important point that women have to be taught from the point of view of sexology. Again, when working out happy marriages, a woman has to be taught that the ketuvah is a two-way street.
For the exam, Benjamin Krauss is there. Zev Itzkowitz is not here. 3010. Shalom Erlbaum is sick. Kill 11 sin must be studying. Naftali Halivar is studying, I hope. Chaim is brave enough to come. Avi Savitsky is studying. Menachem Linzai, I hope these guys are in the course. I'm not wasting my time here. Moshe Sandovsky, brave. Ezra, brave, and his wife as well. He looks happy. Akiva was here. I trust he'll come back. Yair, God, Dove, anyone who's not on the list. No, got you all. Jeremy Fisher. If you ever need credit, Jeremy, it's all being marked down. Just remind me. So, you should know that Sansino Press put out this entire volume on marriage with the imprimatur of the Chief Rabbinate of England, and they have this article among the many articles on the Tarak, this beautiful volume, and there's an article about telling a woman about sex and her role in it and her obligations and to be understanding of the man, etc. And I remember in Michal, suddenly a storm broke out. This is vulgarity. This is coarse. Who ordered this book for the library? And it was one of my first introductions to Israelis and their attitudes towards sex and marriage. And believe me, it sickened me then. It sickens me now if that could be their attitude. But it's an open thing in the ketuvah. You look in the ketuvah, you'll see it. So when do these obligations begin? Answer me. When do they begin? With kedushin or with nesuin? Of course with nesuin. Biyushni is usher, even if you're a Kaddish lady with beer and Rav Mangit, but even if you were, still biyushni. So now look what happens. When do we do the ketuvah? We do the ketuvah before the kedushin. How can you do it then? How can you do it? It first begins with the nesuin. So Minhag Yerushalayim is very interesting. Minhag Yerushalayim, of course the answer is that you can do it before, because Ezra was generous to his wife. He obligated himself 45 minutes before he actually married her. So when you follow me, you were generous. You obligated yourself. This is also the answer. But this Rav Heschel Shechter has in his book, very interesting with the Rav, how the Rav changed his mind. Again, Rav Heschel Chaval, I wish we could ask Rebbe, what did you think 40 years? Because I knew his original viewpoint, and Heschel brings down that he changed his mind. They showed him up, I loved it. But this is why one of the worst problems you have is these ketuvah they prepare in advance. And listen, I'm also a rabbi. I never come to a wedding without the ketuvah prepared. I also come with a second one in case. What do you do if the wedding's delayed and the kedushin is not till after nightfall? They have a difference in dates. They got married for the sake of argument. The chuppah should have been today 4 o'clock. Instead it was 6 o'clock. So the ketubah reads one date, and the kedushin was another date. So you, b'diavad, it's okay. Why? Because you have a right to obligate yourself. I made the obligation a day earlier. And this is talking about the Rav Paskin, according to Rav Heschel Shechta, in the years that I didn't know him. When I knew the Rav, halach l'maisar up close, the Rav would rip up the ketuvah and start all over again. It's a tarach muktam. It's the psul nishtarot. He would go hysterical. Later, he quieted down. It's like a shtar. You have a right to be machai yourself even before you got the money. So what we, that's so therefore malamed zchut in the world and ein hachinami, but minig Yerushalayim is very interesting. The ketuvah is finished under the chuppah. You know what I'm talking about? You, right, the Adam sign under the chuppah. The Kabbalat Kinyan is under the chuppah. That's exactly what they did in Poland. He describes that first they would get the ketuvah ready, but the Adam would not sign. In other words, they would prepare it, but the Adam would not sign. I remember with my daughter, I did a wedding. My eldest daughter got married, so I was the Masada Kedushin. My middle daughter, the Rosh Hashiva Bakotel, was Masada Kedushin, but my eldest daughter was Masada Kedushin. So I remember I prepared a table under the chuppah, because my first experience was in 69 when Rav Eliezer Suva's granddaughter got married. I was an aide on the ketuvah. I signed on a guy's back, but Tzvi Yehuda was Masada Kedushin. And I was new to Israel, and they're under the chuppah, big mob scene. By the way, he asked whether I'm from. I didn't have a beard. So it must be after. It had to be after the 3 weeks. Well, yeah, that's right, because I came in Aliyah. The future can get married. Then I took off my beard for reasons that someday we can explain on Purim. And I didn't have a beard anymore. So there I am standing without a beard. And he asked whether I'm a Shomer Mitzvah. You know, he couldn't believe that guy. They told me he's a Rosh Yeshiva from YU. In those days, you know, from YU you could walk on your hands. Oh, Rosh Yeshiva from YU must be a Shomer Mitzvah. So he doesn't have a beard. You know, it was all right. Today, Baron Khan, you know, would appear Baruch Hashem. No one had any doubts that this man is from. But in those days, it was a problem. So I signed on somebody's back. It was a disgrace. From there I learned, prepare a table. But that's what he says here. Then, listen to this, right after they do the ketuvah, the chatan goes to the merchatz, it means the mikvah, with his friends. So that's very, very interesting that evidently they went to the mikvah. I also went to mikvah before I got married. It's a minhag. Maybe, and I'm only reading into it, that it was also the minhag to go Erev Shabbos. In other words, I have a son-in-law goes every Erev Shabbos, Erev Yom Tov, certainly they go to mikvah. Could be. You see, this is the source here. I have to tell you, I don't want to shock you, but the Rav never went to mikvah. He once let the class have it. He said, yeah, you're all busy on an Erev Yom Kippur. He says, you're all busy, you're running to mikvah. He says, I never went to mikvah in my life. He says, I learned an Erev Yom Kippur. He says, I learned. But all right, what can I do? I didn't change my minhag. All my life I was raised to go to mikvah, Erev Rosh Hashanah, Erev Yom Kippur. I go to mikvah. But the Rav let the boys have it with his sense of humor. He says, yeah, you're busy. But look what you see here, that they go to the merchatz with the kruim. Again, I may be reading into it, but it would seem to me the fact that he goes with his friends would be indicative that you're going to mikvah for the sake of Shabbos, not just for the sake of getting married. Then, I'll challenge you to explain this. The cheno simcha bracha b'yerev called him Hachnasat Shabbat. Can anyone explain that? What does that mean? B'chein osim habracha. Amazing. Simple Hebrew. What does it mean? No way to guess. You can't guess. You have to know the lifestyle time. B'chein osim habracha. You know what the bracha meant? What do you think it meant? The word bracha. Before Hachnasat Shabbat. What does it mean? Gentlemen, very simple. In those days, when there was a wedding, people made pledges to help the young couple. Pledges. Money, what they're going to give. So Gadishi got up, his cousin's getting married, he pledged two pillows. Moshe got up, it's his third cousin getting married, he pledged a set of glasses. I'm serious. Yair got up, he pledged silverware. That's what it means, V'cheinu Simcha Bracha. I only know that through research of that period, because I took courses in the graduate school. It's not my specialty, but there's no way you can figure that out on your own. That's what it means, v'cheinu simcha bracha. Why were the pledges made then? Not on Shabbos. You don't want to run in, because it could very well be that the original minigas, where do you make the pledge at the time of the meal, you understand, they would have speeches at the meal, and they would have the MC get up, and he would say, a drasha gedanke was called, it was called the drasha for the gifts for the chasen kala, it would be at the meal. When the marriage is Erev Shabbos, you cannot do it in Shabbos, they say, oh, dog, you have to come and learn it, it's a mitzvah, but not at kibbeikach, before Shabbos. Then, after the bracha was over, they would take the chasen and kala to the chatzer beit knesset. That's where they had the weddings. By the way, never in the beit knesset. You know that. That's where Reb Heschel brings down. It's already the famous chatam sofa. Our minig was never to have a wedding in a shul. Why don't you have a wedding in a shul? A wedding is uvda dechol. You don't realize that a wedding is, with all its beauty and all the bracha. Yeah, that's the famous chatam sofa. When they began, how can you have a wedding in a shul? It's a mecha chamemka. You're buying a wife. You're guaranteeing. You're giving the ketuvah. It's a mecha chamemka. Then the Jews started imitating the guy. I mean, that was the famous chatam sofa. The truth of the matter is that today we keep quiet. We build the shul al tanai, because the truth of the matter is it's a lot better to have a wedding in a shul. When it's in a shul today, the rabbi can see that it's proper. You have control. So today already, we build the shul on Tanai, and one of the things we do when we build the shul, we make a plan, we'll be able to have weddings, etc. And all of you know, the great synagogue, they pull open the ceiling, you get married there, and there's dance under the stars, etc. But the Peshul brings down in his book, on one of his, when he spoke, I don't know if I heard it on tape, I saw it in the Nefesh HaRav, that the Rav was being driven to a wedding to be Masada Kedushin, and he got a little bit upset when he found out it's in a shul, but he said, look, I obligated myself to be Masada Kedushin, so I don't want to cause embarrassment to the Chasen V'Kala. But of course, Lachatchila, he would prefer not, and that's what that was the minhag, the chatzah beit knesset. Yeah, he wouldn't come in his shul. Well, listen, it's a famous chatam sofa. I can't argue with a chatam sofa, and I know what he says. But I'm telling you, between the lines, if you build it on tanai, there is an advantage today. It gives you control. It gives you dignity. So we can't dismiss it. I have to say, in America, some of my best students got married in shuls, and they told me that's miniga makam, orthodox shuls, they build it al tanai, and I understand the rabbi can control it. See, that's very important, that the rabbi should be able to control. In Israel, it's not. You don't get married in shuls. Outside of Yerushalayim, I've seen the great synagogue. At the same Tel Aviv, too, they've used the great synagogue for weddings, and I have to assume it was built al tanai. But if you tell me Rav David didn't go to a wedding, though, I understand it very well. And then he describes the Birchat HaRusin, and after the Birchat HaRusin, the Achakach Korei HaMavarei HaKtuva HaEdim Chotmim Bo VeKoremimo BeNachar. I have to tell you, this is with such lumdus. Why do the Edim have to read the Ketuvah with the person reading it aloud? The Edim have to know what they're signing on. If you've ever seen me be Masada Kedushin, I absolutely insist the Edim look over my shoulder when I'm preparing the Ketuvah and read it with me word by word afterwards. They should know what they're signing on. Because they're Edim. And look at their minig there. It was like they would read it with him, and then they would make, he would give it to the Kala, and then they would make the Birchat Nesuin, and then they would take the cup, and that very cup in which they made the Birchat Nesuin, they would put on the floor, and he would stamp on it and break it. So it teaches you another concept, that they used a simple glass cup. In other words, what do we use for Siddur Kedushin? Generally speaking, we use a kos. No one is going to step on a silver kos and break it and disfigure it, and who can break it? It'll break your foot. But they evidently used a simple glass kos, and that was the kos they put on the floor and broke. And then, of course, he describes when they'd go away, and this minig we don't have anymore, when they would lead the chatan v'kala away, they would throw a tanagol on the head of the chatan, a tanagolit on the head of the kala. And this, of course, is based upon the Gemara in Gittin, Daf Nun Zayin, Omer Aleph, Brua Ravu, Ketana Golem. So there you have an amazing description of Chuppah V'Kedushin in Poland in the early 1500s. Look how different it is from us today. Number one, it's Erev Shabbos. Number two, you have the bracha. Number three, in the middle of the festivities, the chatan runs off to mikveh with his friends. Number four, minig Yerushalayim with the ketuvah. Number five, the very coast you use for the bracha, you throw on the floor. Well, to what I said, and one thing, just a minute, number six, the Tanagol, based upon the Gemara in Gittin, which you're all familiar with. Dov, the answer is very simple. Lumdus, you're asking, why do we have the minhag like Yerushalayim with the Ketubah? Because Lumdus wise, you're right, it's correct. It's very hard to do. It's very difficult. Right. So you should know, I've never yet been Masada Kedushin, I don't want to say hundreds of times, tens and tens of times, I've never yet had a wedding where I always insist we have to have the wedding when the Ketubah is written. You understand? And I've always succeeded in pulling it off. But b'diavad, you run a risk. But the other side of the coin is it's too hard to sign under the chuppah. It loses dignity. You understand? No one thinks in advance. No one sets up a table. It becomes a hodgepodge. So that's why the easier minhag won out. But right, you're absolutely right. I agree with you 1,000%. I agree with you 1,000%. You're absolutely right. It makes a bigger hefsek. Everything is right. But somehow, the easier minhag going out, be the avad, this is what was samachan. I already saw in America this year, I forget where I was. I was at a wedding, wherever it was, where the taka was, I forget it was Masada Kedushin, but it was some heavyweight and whatnot. And the tuvah had one date, and the wedding was another date. I saw it with my own eyes. But I can tell you, in the years I have been in Masada Kedushin, the times I have been, I always tell them, if you're setting a date before Shkia, be aware that everyone has to be there and the Kippah has to begin 20 minutes before sunset. You know, but the evidence, if you run into sunset and most of it is over, it's not the end of the world. But 20 minutes before sunset, you have to go to Kippah. And I'm makted on it. But you're right. You're right. Okay. Gentlemen, now, what do we do? Here we come. Now we're sailing. What do we do? But the problems exist. Even in Poland, the girls were beautiful. You think the Sfadim don't have a monopoly on beautiful girls? As a matter of fact, all the Sfadic rabbis I know are married Ashkenazic students of mine. One by one, you can go down the line from Deal to Brooklyn. Every last one I know. The only exception is, of course, Ralph Tawil, who's the biggest lamdan of any student I ever taught. What Ralph's knowledge is, you know that? You know that or not? His knowledge is unbelievable. I mean, when I had him as a Talmud, he was one of the best Talmud I ever taught. I had him in BMT as a little kid, and then I had him in the Kollel for a few years. He was outstanding. He's taka married within the family. Outside of that, one by one, they married Ashkenaziyot. So the Sfadiyot don't have a monopoly on good looks, although, Baruch Hashem, they're beautiful girls too. So you have them in Poland too, they grab girls off the street. Notice now the Polish approach. The Polish approach was never Hafkat Kedusha. Can't do it. Their approach was, beat the hell out of the animal that acted in such a fashion. And now, let me show you something. Let me show you now. What I'm about to quote, and these are all rare sources, you have to be able to come up with them. This is from the Yarbuch, Frankfurt on Main, the Lehrenschaften Gesellschaft. Now, what does this mean? Frankfurt, there was a society, Frankfurt on Main, which was near Ve'im Yisrael. Frankfurt on Main had a society for scientific Jewish scholarship. And they published a yearbook once a year of articles and scholarship. This is from the 1916 yearbook, volume 11. They published the Krakow Jewish Community Ordinances as published in Krakow in 1595. Now, I'm quoting to you Ordinance 83 from the Krakow Jewish Community, 1595, and this goes back, what I'm about to quote to you, goes back to the earliest great rabbin in Poland. They say that all of Judaism in Poland comes from him, Reb Shalom Shachna. He was the father-in-law of the Ramah. This is Reb Shalom Shachna, the father-in-law of the Ramah. And I'm quoting from this article. This is all published from manuscript. Now, it's in Yiddish. I'll translate. It's very fascinating. V'hamakadesh o'motzi kol lag shel kedushin al betula al almon al gerusha u'makadesh b'lo chuppah. Exactly the problem. That a guy wants to grab this woman, whether she's a virgin, a betula, or maybe she's a wealthy almana. Believe me, enough novels and movies have been made and written about men who latch on to wealthy women for their money. What do they call them? Gigolos. You marry a woman 20 years older than you, but Baruch Hashem, there are millions that are going to be put at your disposal. So this guy wants this betula or wants this almana, and he sends out the concept. I was Makadisha, but he didn't do it. There was no chuppah, there was no publicity, it was not done with a minion, it was not done with a rabbi, it was done haphazardly in an underground fashion. So you know what the ordinance is? The person who did it, he's in Chayrim. He's in Nidui. Mit Malkus in Yisturim Strafin. And you should beat the hell out of him with Malkut. I'll give you a source. I'll show you something in a minute. Hein al yidei Yehudim, whether it's Jews or al yidei Arelim, have the oishir higher goyim to do it. Beat the hell out of this guy. Un kol hakoyel is mechuyev to help him, and everyone in the community has to help to punish this man. Don't let him get away. There is a pateret mit guten willen, and he has to give her a get out of his own free will. V'chein hiskim ha-goyin moreinu ha-rav reb shach nizal v'tolmidav ha-charav alufei Torah al davar zeh. And this is what ha-goyin reb shalom shachner, the Rebbe of Reb Moshe Ristlis, instituted. All his talmidim agreed. Anyone marrying a woman in a clandestine fashion, in a secretive fashion, beat the hell out of him. Punish him. Force him to give a get. Not one word here of Hafkat Kedushin, but beat the hell out of him. Avner, listen to me carefully. I know you have jet lag, but don't miss what I'm about to tell you. Gentlemen, no. If I'm telling you this is something, this is the height of today's shit. This is very special. The source I'm about to give you, you have no idea. Now, gentlemen, what's going on here? What are these fancy words? Rakefet comes into class today. And imagine, beat the hell out of this guy. I met someone from Shas on Wednesday. I wanted to kill him, hang him, slap him, curse him, maledict him. Only thing is, I realized who I met while I was driving in the car to my mother 20 minutes later. What am I going to do? I beat him. What am I, crazy? I'll beat him. I'll be thrown into jail. I don't have time to sit in jail. Curse him out? All right. I'll curse him under my breath. He won't even hear. Look at these words here. What are they talking about? Beat him. Not only that, if you can't do it, get Gentiles to do it. What are they talking about? What's going on? Is this figurative? Is this daydreaming? Or is this to be taken literally? Gentlemen, the rabbis had this power. Every word is to be taken literally. It seems that in Poland, at this time, and it continues practically until the 18th century, practically, the rabbis had unbelievable power. Poland was ruled by the church. The church beat the hell out of its adherents, and they were perfectly willing to step aside and let the Jews beat the hell out of Jews that sinned. And the rabbis had this power. This is mamish halacha l'maisa. This is not figuratively, but literally. This is why Hafkat Kedushin never became a factor. And they didn't pay off the sinner. They beat the hell out of him. Shuto kamashmo, until he agreed, Moshe, to give a get out of his own free will and volition. Now, where do we have a major source? How do I know my interpretation is right? How do I know I'm correct? By the way, I'm in debt. Simcha Asaf did all the basic research on this. It's his classic work on Onshin in rabbinic literature throughout the generations. Gentlemen, you've heard of the Maran Lublin, you've learned Gemara, and you've opened up the back of the Gemara, and on the Omer is the Mashar, the Mashal, and the Maran Lublin. Right or wrong? The Maran Lublin is very famous for his collection of Tshuvot. Tshuvot Maram Lublin. Gentlemen, you're going to go to the bookcase and you're going to take out a Maram Lublin and you're going to say, oh, the Rebbe said to look up Tshuva Kuf Lamed Chet. Kuf Lamed Chet. You're going to go crazy. You're going to find Kuf Lamed Zayin. You're going to find Kuf Lamed Tet. You are not going to find Kuf Lamed Chet. Can anyone tell me why? You're going to go crazy. You're going to go through what I went through many years ago, the first time I sought out this tshuva. I went out of my mind. I went out of my mind. I'm counting, I'm looking. What's going on with me? 137? 139? Where's 138? The census took it out. In modern times, chas v'chalil, if you're familiar with the Napoleonic Sanhedrin, you know what I'm talking about. Either there's secular law or there's Torah law. Both cannot function simultaneously. The census took it out. Gentlemen, if you take any edition of the Maram Lublin's tshuva that is simply published from photograph, you will not find this tshuva. It's gone. The one published in Israel, what they did, and this is the problem, type was never reset. All they did was in back of the Maram Lublin, they photographed an early edition of the tshuva. So what you have is in back of a modern tshuva, where the type was evidently set, let's say, in Vilna 100 years ago, and it's modern type. In back, you have the tshuva added in old-fashioned type, where letters are run together, photographed from an early edition of the Ram Lublin. The problem is that no one put a footnote or put an asterisk on the appropriate page to tell you, for Kuf Lamed Chet, turn to the end of the volume. That's what you have to do. You have to turn to the end of the volume. Gentlemen, it all depends on what edition you have. Some editions, Kuf Lamed Chet has vanished like American baseball. It is not there. It is not to be found. If you want to relax after surviving a trip to the Middle East, you watch a football game. And in the middle of a touchdown, they kill you. It's unbelievable. But it's unbelievable. Unbelievable. Millions of dollars were offered to get the President of the United States. The Hamas would have given anything. And the guy, billions of dollars. You have any idea what was spent on security? You fellas don't even start to understand what it cost you as the American taxpayer. Every minute, no, I saw what they flew in to the Ramada Renaissance, the press center, to the King David. Millions of dollars worth of equipment, expense, and security. And they smacked the Israelis. You know, we have no self-respect. Their security took over the Knesset. They were giving orders to our people. And they get back to America. Shoot up the White House. Gentlemen, just as there's no baseball, there's no Kuf Lamed Chet. If you get the edition published in Israel, photographed and republished in America, it's been republished 2 or 3 times in the last 30, 40 years, there you'll find Kuf Lamed Chet in back. Why did the census take it out? It's exactly what I told you before. Napoleonic Sanhedrin, if you recall the whole incident, Napoleon forced the Jews to say, Master Napoleon, in the modern world, you are our king, you are our boss, the Jewish religion becomes a spiritual concept. It has no practical inference. Meaning, in order to get married, we need permission of the government. Those of you who got married in America know it all began when you went to get a blood test and some Puerto Rican sent you to some black Afro-American who took your blood and then they gave you permission to get married. You want to get divorced in America, you have to go into court first, even before you dream of a get. Whip a person for not giving a get, it cannot be done. Only the government can execute and whip for what they consider crimes. And this is what Napoleon forced the Jew to say. The censors didn't want the Jews to see a tshuva like this.
it would mislead them that the rabbis really have power. Now, what is Kuf Lamed said about? Why is it so crucially important? And it's an amazing tshuva, and it shows you what power Rav Shalom Shachmach had, and what power the rabbis had in Poland, at least until 1648, at least until 1648, at least until the Chmielnytskyi massacres, that's for sure. Maybe a vestige of this power continued even for another 50 years afterwards. What's the Shaila? Kuf Lamed Chet, very simple. You think only today Jews murder other Jews? I mean, think for a minute. You know, it's nothing to laugh about. 14 women killed by their husbands. This morning, they practically killed a policeman, the man in charge of Bitachon at the jail in the center of the country, Who shot him? The man is in critical condition. Who shot him? Three people. At least we know for sure one of them is a chassid of Harav Uzi Meshulam. I mean, these are firm Jews with yarmulkes on and tzitzit. They're shooting at other Jews. Ribbono shel Olam. I used to feel offended when they read the Ten Commandments. I walked out of shul. I said, I'm offended. Every man, I got to hear them say, Lo Tietzach, Lo Tiknof, Lo Tinof. In my life, I never dreamt of killing, robbing, committing adultery. Ribbono shel Olam, what kind of Torah is this I'm listening to? Do you think only today Jews are killers? Here we have it. A Jew killed another Jew. And everyone knows about it. And v'harotzeichu b'maseh uv'mishma b'yad ha'pikid. And the secular authorities have arrested this murderer. And the Maram is asked, what should we do to him? And the Maram says, kill him. Execute him. Aye. How are you allowed to execute him? There's all the halacha of Dalad Mitat Beitin and Hitat Smola Mita and Hatra'ah. We banish Elohim. All of you have heard lectures on the Torah Shabbatab and Torah Shabbatah. All of you have heard lectures. Is Judaism in favor of death penalty? Aren't we in favor? How can you kill him? None of the qualifications are met. Nothing is met of the halacha. Nothing is met of Masechet Sanhedrin. How are you allowed to kill him? And of course, the Maram Milublin quotes the Gemara in Yevamot, Daf Tzadi Yomet Bet. It's a Gemara in Yevamot. It's also elsewhere in Shas, but I'm quoting it from Yevamot. Yevamot, Daf Tzadi Yomet Bet. A very famous Gemara. Where the Gemara says, Beitin has a right. Makin in Oinshin, Shalom in Hadin. Kenny, you know what I'm talking about? That a Beitin has the right to give punishments when they feel it is necessary. You understand? And they give the example, the famous example, that a person rode on a horse on Shabbat at the time of the Yevanim, at the time of the Greeks, the Hellenizers, and they killed him. Now, we punish a lot of them. All of you know, riding on a horse on Shabbat, come on, what's going on here? What are you doing? You're killing the person. And they say they had to do it to set an example. They give another example. A man had intercourse with his wife in a public park. All right. Well, listen, nowadays, no one even stopped to look. It's Maisim B'chol Yom. What's the big deal? A person has intercourse on stage, on a movie, on a public park. Maisim B'chol Yom. It's sad, but in those days they yet had a feeling of sneer. What's wrong? The man said, it's my wife. What's wrong? I had intercourse in public. Don't I eat supper in public? Don't I go into a restaurant? Don't I sit in a cafe in public? Don't I sit in a cafe? Okay, what was that called? Atara cafe? I sit beside her. But it's not sanua. So they beat the hell out of the guy. Al-Pidin, he's right. What did he do wrong? He did something not sanua, but you don't give malkut for it. No. The times required it, and they gave malkut. It seems that in this case, under discussion, this murderer was so wicked and so evil that everyone knew about it, so that the Maram Lublin says, let the goyim kill him. Encourage them, he says. Better they should do it than we should do it. But if this person is left alive, it's going to be a big Chilul Hashem. And let the goyim execute this person. Let them see that we Jews value life. And let them understand that if you kill anyone,
you are obligated to incur the death penalty, and he paskins la halacha, execute this man. Now, what's amazing here is more than just the tshuva. The tshuva itself relating to killing the man, all right, the man was a murderer, but he tells a story in the tshuva. This is the Maram Lublin, and he says, he's telling already a story, like the Rav. Like the Rav would tell stories about the Chaim, about Rav Moshe, about the Velvel, about the Netziv, about his family. So the Maram Lublin says, I'm quoting word by word, what does bimei chupi mean? The rabbinic expression, when I was young, chupi, sharp, your mind is sharp. I don't want to hurt your feelings, but biology knows that by the age of 24, you start losing tens of thousands of brain cells every day. 24, you're over the hill intellectually. And they don't know exactly how it affects you, but one thing is certain, your mind is never as sharp again. And that's the rabbinic expression, bimei chupi. You understand what I'm saying? And I know this. I don't want to. I know this. I know a lot more today than when I was in my early 20s. But my mind was much sharper then. Much sharper. That's be made for P. And every year, listen, this is part of the life process. Thank God we can talk about it 40 years later. I'm not complaining. Be made for P. That's the Gemara. So the Gemara says that Bimei Chupi, he says, when I was young, I remember that Bimei Hagon Moreno Harav Reb Shachna, and he tells the following story. There was a rotten, terrible Jew. Ish Ra Ubliyal. Listen carefully, you won't believe your ears. A rotten Jew. What he did, he doesn't say, but I can imagine he was a Machalu Shabbos, he lived with Goyim, who knows? And he says, the Goyim Rabbeinu Shachna, Paskin Lahalacha, capture this Jew, and take his eyes out. Linaker et shnei enav, ulach tochet l'shano, and chop his tongue out. From this I can infer, he evidently snitched to the Gentiles, he was a Meiser, he was a Malshin, and he Paskin Lahalacha. This is what they should do. Gentlemen, they went and they did it. They took his eyes out. They chopped his tongue off. And it was the biggest mistake. Why? They should have killed him. Why? Look what happened. I'm reading to you from the tshuva. That after Liachasha Sulo Kaleila, he mir daito, he became a Catholic. Nasa akumachad. V'holid b'nei zedim, v'hayu hu v'zaro, ha'mera'im kol yemehem, l'ritzua mardut l'Yisrael. And he says, the man was alive, he had married a Gentile woman. It shows you how Gentile women preferred the Jewish men, even if they're blind and part of their tongue is missing, but they don't get drunk, they don't beat their wives. He had children with her, and he and his children persecuted the Jews whenever they could and were a constant mikshel, a constant minefield to the Jewish people. And he says, we made the biggest mistake, not killing the person. So he comes back to the question under discussion. Meyacha, that this murderer, Shehumi Poshe Yisrael Begufam, that this man is a Poshe Yisrael, V'yein bo kakanet, that this person is totally bad. He describes him like a snake. And all he can do is cause harm for the Jewish people. Thank God the Gentiles have captured him. And he says, that let the Gentiles kill him. Let the Goalei Hadam, let the relatives of the deceased come to the Gentiles. Demand that the Pagid should nikmat dam hanishpach al yedei hapakid sheyivarenu min halam v'al yedei ze yigadru hapritzim v'yitkadesh shem shemayim v'chol Yisrael heyu nikiyim. And we are not guilty. Yadeinu nikiyim. Yadeinu lo shafru et hadam hazeh. And Nu'un Meir ben Moreinu Harav Gedalia. This is the tshuva. What a tshuva. Do you understand the importance of this tshuva? It is a landmine of information. A landmine. Who would believe
that rabbis actually had this power and executed Jews. And this will explain to you, at the time of the original Rebbe, in the 1800s, the tremendous machloket between the Hasidim and the Maskilim, and you're getting involved with Jerusification, and the Maskilim were snitching to the government. And there would be Maskilim who constantly walked with bodyguards for fear that Hasidim were out to kill them. And it's the famous case, the early 1800s, where a Maskil on Yom Kippur didn't walk with bodyguards. He felt safe on Yom Kippur. No Jew is going to kill him. And P.S., the body was found, dug up, right next to the mikveh. And of course, the original Rebbe was arrested. Some of the Hasidim were arrested. They were tortured. Some died. This is the famous story. This is how the original Rebbe winds up in Sadagura. When he's finally released from jail some 22 months later, if you recall, and this went on in Russia until modern times, until the evil communist empire fell only a few years ago, when you were released from jail, you're still in exile. You couldn't go back to your original place of residence. And the original Rebbe had to move to Sadagura on that condition. He was allowed out of jail. But this is a tradition. Rabbis gave out a psak. This person is chayav mitah. And look at this tshuva. That take his eyes out, cut his tongue out. The biggest mistake. Because as long as he's alive, he can hate you. He can fight you. He can maledict you. He can snitch on you. He can tell the Gentiles terrible stories about the Jews. Get rid of him. Kill him all together. And this was the psak of the Maram Lublin. But more important of the psak of the Maram Lublin was the story he's telling about Rabbeinu Harav Shachna. So look what you see from here. That in the 1500s into the 1600s, this was Minhag HaMakom. This was rabbinic power. And now you can start to understand what we talk about with the Vaad Arba'a Ratzot, when they spoke about putting Jews in jail. And now you can understand when they dig up or find ancient shuls before the Hitler period in Eastern Europe, they found something very strange, that sometimes in the shuls, right next to the entrance, was a caged room. And no one understood what that was. Those rooms were jails. People who didn't listen to the rabbi, they put you into jail. And Shabbat, everyone walked past, saw you in jail, you were in Chayrim, you were Menuda, you didn't want to give a get. Believe me, you gave a get right afterwards. You suffered one Shabbos of disgrace like that, you gave a get. Rabbis had power. And this explains to you why Napoleon went after the rabbis. What did Napoleon want out of them? Those 12 questions he asked. Some of the questions make no sense. Do the rabbis possess police jurisdictional power? What is Napoleon talking about? And remember, Napoleon was a genius. Not only was he a genius, he had his entire staff, those that helped him, his ministers, Count Molé, others, they knew what they were doing. What type of question was this? I can understand a question, what is it, question number two or three, when he says, are Jews and Gentiles allowed to intermarry? I can understand that question very well. I can understand questions 11 and 12. Are you allowed to take interest from a Jew? Are you allowed to take interest from a Gentile? But when he gets involved, I believe it's 8, 9, or 7, 8, 9, where he gets involved of jurisdictional power, police jurisdictional power for rabbis, what is Napoleon talking about? Yair, you now understand Napoleon 100%. He was saying to the Jews, put up or shut up. If you're going to come out of the ghetto and you're going to be part of modern France and you want all the rights of French citizenship, you have to accept the responsibilities. And we can't have two legal systems. If Napoleon wants to whip you, or wants to execute you, or wants to put you in jail, this is the privilege of Napoleon and the civil law. But the rabbis can't do it. We can't have two forms of government. You want to get married religiously? By the way, in France until today, you know, you must have, anyone know? Can anyone tell me what the big difference between France and America is? In France, you must have two marriage ceremonies. Religion has nothing to do with the marriage. Not like America. America, you have a rabbi, files papers with the government, he's authorized. Oh, not in France. You don't know that? In France, many of the wealthy Sephardic Jews in France get married on Wednesday in France, fly to Israel for Shabbos, and Sunday, they make chuppah v'kiddushin here. And I saw with my own eyes. I once saw the Baba Sali, of Yisrael, with my own eyes, I'll never forget that sight, at the King David, and as he walked away, the father of the bride put a check for $100,000 in his hands. I saw it with my own eyes. That's Siddur Kaddishin. That's the Baba Sali. That's what you call respect for Rabbanim, Ribbono Shel Olam. That's what you call proper living. But you have two marriage ceremonies. You didn't know that. Moshe, you didn't know that? Until today, ask any Frenchman. You have to have a civil marriage. Then you go. You want to get married? That's your business. Private. It's not public. Can't whip people. Can't kill people. Can't maledict people. Can't throw them into a cage. This is the Maram Lublin. What a tshuva. This is the Kufa Medchet. This is the tshuva that is missing. And this explains to you the Takana. And you're going to see from all the sources I give you next week, Hafkot Kedushin, Mandach Hashmei. It is never mentioned. Keep the hell out of the guy who does it. That's the way they approach the problem in Poland, where some of us have our roots at this time in our march before God and man. So to reiterate, the class began today. I said a lot of words on Rav Goren with the whole Israel. Those were important words, right? You know, beyond Rav Goren, the whole Israeli situation. It's the problem. It's the heart of some of the problems we're caught up with today. And even understanding the newspapers, imagine Rav Goren quotes the Gemara in the Durham. They're so ignorant, they don't realize he's quoting the Gemara, and they're criticizing him yet for what he's saying, which is an open Gemara. But this is what we're caught up in, and this, by the way, is the heart of our problem. And this is why I, for one, can never forgive Shas, because they created merits. Merits was Muktzah Machmat Miyusir. And along came Shas, and gave them the two most sensitive ministries, education and absorption. You can't have any more sensitive ministries from the point of view of religion. It's much more important than the religious ministry or anything else you mention. And put it into the hands of people who have nothing to do with Judaism whatsoever. Shem Yerachim. And these are our problems. This is what we're caught up in. And this is what we're living. This is what we're going through. And it's very much a part of the news today, if you heard Rav Avadya's pronouncement against Rav Azran, who announced he's leaving Shas. But anyway, take my words of Hesper within context. I think it's an accurate picture of Rav Goren, his greatness, and yet the tragedy. It's a shame, the tragedy of a man who couldn't find himself after the army. Couldn't find himself. It's just tragic, sad. Even in death, he issued an order. Rabbi Lau shouldn't come. Did Rabbi Lau come finally? You don't know what happened. He issued an order. You should see. He shouldn't come. His family. It's sad. Greatness, but yet the vicissitudes and the maelstrom of the contemporary Israeli existence. We don't have answers. Many problems, we don't have answers to all. Then we went into the material we wanted to cover today, at least part of it. I summarized the last era, and we went into the Mara Mintz, the marriage ceremony in Poland, the ordinance of the Krakow community, and the tshuva of the Maram Lublin. Gentlemen, I wouldn't miss Tuesday's class as the Igeret turns into a sefer, even though you have all the pressures of the cows and the sheep waiting to be slaughtered. Until we meet again in health and happiness, Das Vedanya. Thank you very much.